Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many people describe joint replacement as one of the most innovative inventions that makes a massive difference to the community of the last century. Unfortunately, it's not often allocated according to clinical need. And there's massive evidence suggesting that if you come from the wrong side of the street and you have less income, if you come from a rural area, or you're of a certain ethnicity, you're much less likely to see a surgeon and to have your joint replaced, along with a number of other aspects of arthritis care. This inequity or disparity in care also drives worse long-term outcomes and greater rates of complication. It's an incredibly complex area, one of great controversy, and one that continues to cause huge concerns for people that have osteoarthritis. And it's that topic of disparity, particularly in joint replacement as it relates to osteoarthritis, that we dig into today. And we're pleased to have as our guest, Professor Jaz Singh. Jaz is a professor of medicine and epidemiology and holds an endowed professor of medicine, and he's the director of rheumatology research at the Birmingham VA Medical Center. Hello, Jaz. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, David. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, thank you for separating some time from your clinic and coming down and having a chat to us. Before we get into the main content, I'm just wondering if you could share with the listeners a little bit more about your background and what a typical day might look like.
Sure. So I'm a rheumatologist by training and a researcher by trade. So I spend a lot of time researching diseases and problems and solutions that we need for people with various arthritis and joint diseases and immune diseases. So I also do see patients 1 day a week. So a typical day is usually spending maybe 4 to 6 hours in research-related activities and maybe a couple of hours in patient-based, clinic-based activities, and then seeing patients, also some supervision of trainees and resident fellows in training, both for clinical training as well as for research training.
You sound like you have an incredibly full plate, which I guess brings us back to that balance topic that we started before we started recording. But which of those activities do you find most fulfilling or enjoyable?
By far, without a doubt, patient care. That's my happiest day of the week. That's the day I feel like I could push for another 4 hours and not feel hungry or distracted or frustrated. So for some reason, the activity that I only devote 25% of my time is definitely the most enjoyable, the happiest day when I get to take care of people, but also, you know, they share their experiences with me and a lot of stories and lots of great conversations. That's not to say research world is not exciting and we don't have fun, but I think by far those times definitely win in terms of happiness.
Yeah, yeah. So Jazz, when you're not busy doing all of the stuff you do in the clinic and in the research world, what do you do enjoying outside of work?
So my hobbies, I'm pretty boring guy, but my hobbies are actually sitting out and staring at nature and just sitting there feeling the wind, looking at the birds, hear the birds chirping. And every now and then we get to do some trekking with kids. Both my kids are very fond of trekking. We don't get as much time to do that together as a family. But I think that sitting there and just looking out at the sky, trees, we get lucky, we go by the beach or the mountains every now and then, but mostly it's in the backyard and we're up on a hill, so we have still some trees left that we can look at. And usually, you know, before 8 a.m., there's still, you know, you can still hear the sounds of nature much more than you hear sounds of automobiles. So that's probably my best hobby, I would say. It might sound very boring, but I enjoy it a lot.
No, not at all, not at all. And so where you live in Alabama, and particularly in Birmingham, is there plenty of opportunity to get exposed to nature, to go hiking?
There is. There are actually a lot of very good mountains to trek. And so we have friends who are very fond of trekking, so they will drag us out there. Just that when life takes over, you forget that you have such a great resource right next to you. Obviously, we didn't have that so much trekking in Minnesota where we were before Alabama. I wish we'd go for trekking more frequently, more often. Just the day to day, you know, with kids' classes and all various kinds of activities they're committed to, and dropping and picking them up at school and otherwise, it just takes away a lot of leisure time. And before you know, it's Monday.
Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. Now, Jazz, if you had to describe yourself in 5 words, what would they be?
I'd say learner trying to be more humble.
It's great. It's a great way to be. Yeah. I mean, I think oftentimes humility gets underestimated in modern society, and there's a lot of I want to call it brash confidence that is not necessarily based on merit, that gets overinflated. So yeah, humility is a great quality. Jazz, now the topic of the day is disparities, and you've contributed massively to this area, and obviously you and Kent Kuo and a range of other people have really dug into this really, I think, controversial but so important area of health service delivery, particularly as it relates to total joint replacement. But before I guess we get into some of the challenges that we're facing, just wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about what is disparity?
So to me, disparity is all the differences that, at least in the healthcare setup, is not really defined by biology or disease-based differences, but rather by differences in social, political, economic, and environmental resources and barriers, I think. So there are differences in access to several of these very important determinants from both resources, but also I think there are specific barriers that are at all those different levels. So what is not defined by biology and physiology as we understand it, but more so by these external factors.
Yeah, and so I guess just to briefly recap, so this is not based upon disease severity or based necessarily upon clinical need, but based upon factors such as you said, socioeconomic divide, ethnicity, location, so rural, regional. Now, based upon that, I guess, definition of disparity, how does that relate to people having joint replacement surgery for osteoarthritis. What have you and others found in that space?
So I think there is a lot of literature in the total joint replacement that really exemplifies a lot of disparities. And they're not only by race, ethnicity, they are by rural urban divide, they are by healthcare access, meaning whether you have in a given setting or country some sort of an insurance or a program that allows you access, or you have a hybrid system whereby everybody has access through a socialized healthcare network, but people who have more resources can then have better access to a parallel system. And also, as you alluded to, the socioeconomic status per se, which not only includes how much you earn, but also where you live, what sort of education background you have, and what sorts of community and locale-based resources you have. So I think there's lots of disparities that we know in joint replacement for osteoarthritis that have been very well described across a lot of countries, not just in one country or one type of group that has disadvantaged, but across different nations, across different settings, differences by location, by race, ethnicity, by insurance, by socioeconomic status, and some by sex as well. So we have lots of clear evidence and replication of those findings across different settings, which increases our confidence that these are not just a few instances, a few exceptions, that they're more or less a systematic difference and a systematic difference in resources and barriers between different groups of people.
That's wonderful. So let's dig into that a little bit further. And I guess each of those different types of barriers one at a time. But I guess in the first instance, can we just talk a little bit about ethnicity and race, particularly as it relates to access to joint replacement or access to other types of care that might occur prior to total joint replacement, as it relates to ethnicities where you and others have done work in that space, and I guess some of the major differences that have been found there.
Sure. So when we talk about race, ethnicity, there are lots of gaps between racial minorities and ethnic minorities versus those that are not minorities. And these differences are not only in terms of access to specialists such as orthopedic surgeons, but also access to imaging, access to joint injections, and medical treatments and diagnosis before they get to an orthopedic surgeon. And there have been very good studies at state level and also at national levels in a variety of places, especially in several U.S. populations, that have alluded to these differences. There's also less likelihood of somebody who's African-American or Hispanic or Asian to be referred to an orthopedic surgeon compared to a Caucasian American. And since there are delays in referral, as well as decreased frequency of referral, it's not surprising that when you compare the white American patient with osteoarthritis presenting for a joint replacement and compared to their racial ethnic counterparts, you would find that those that are racial ethnic minorities are more likely to have a worse pain scale, a worse quality of life, and worse function when they're coming into surgery. And then not surprisingly, when they are post-op or long-term outcomes in terms of pain function, quality of life, even though they improve in everybody after surgery, the racial minorities never seem to catch up and have as great an outcome as somebody who is white, you know, in our case, let's say a white American. So white population tends to have the best outcomes, and they present early, they present with less pain function, quality of life problems, and they tend to gain the most after surgery. And there's also higher likelihood if you are non-white racial ethnic minority, for you to be discharged to a setting other than home, such as a long-term facility or a nursing home, either because your post-op course is not that favorable or because you have a complication, which is also higher in minorities, or because the social support structure and the resources at home are not that great. Just to take it as an example, you know, my neighbor, who is in his late 60s, underwent knee replacement and was ready for the other knee replacement in about a month and a half. And I said, "Hey, Joe, what's going on?" And he said, "Well, my elder daughter came to take care of me, and now she's gone back. And this time my younger daughter will come. And when she leaves, then my son will come." So again, his family could take time away from work because of the resources they have. And therefore, he's ready to have both his knee replacements a month and a half apart. Now compare that to somebody who's not that socioeconomically viable and not that affluent, and they have their children in jobs where they cannot take off for a month or 2 months to take care of dad, obviously is going to delay their surgery. So there are a variety of factors, and that's what I mean by barriers that people face from social, economic, and environmental resources. This is an example of an economic environmental resource that my neighbor had, and probably somebody in downtown Birmingham may not have. And so those are the real life barriers, although we sort of describe this in a variety of ways in our work. For a real person, a lot of times it's, you know, is their spouse sicker than them? And a lot of times that is also related to social, socioeconomic, racial, ethnic differences in average income and mobility in those populations of same ages. They may be residing, you know, 15 miles apart in different parts of the same suburb or same city, but they're miles apart in terms of resources and their health.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great explanation of a particularly problematic area. And presumably similar concerns about disparity or inequity relate to where a person lives, and particularly the rural versus urban areas. And I just wonder if you could just expand a little bit upon that contribution to disparity.
Sure. So I think that is, again, there's a stark difference, at least in the U.S. setting, in terms of outcomes between rural U.S. residents and urban residents. And as David, you sort of alluded to, people who are residing in rural areas tend to have both less access as well as worse outcomes after joint replacement. And some of that relates to the fact that healthcare services are not that easily available, and the choices they have in terms of high volume orthopedic surgeons or high volume hospitals is much less than people who are in non-rural urban areas. Again, you know, there is also a socioeconomic divide between rural America and urban America. There is a significant income difference in these two Americas. There's also other challenges that people living in rural areas have in terms of access to rehab facilities and the demands they may have from their occupation. So we have a lot less blue-collared workers and white-collared workers in rural areas. And a lot of these patients of mine are farmers, and or they are very physically active jobs. And when they have to make a decision about a joint replacement, you know, it might mean they have to quit their job or take retirement. And they may not have that luxury that a lot of my other patients, let's say a stockbroker living in downtown Birmingham, might have. Or somebody who's running his own company could take off for 2 months and have a partner take care of it. However, my farmer who's residing in a rural county in Alabama certainly won't be able to do that in many instances. So there are significant barriers that my patients in rural areas have. You know, they also have to drive 200 miles or 100 miles or sometimes 300 miles to get to a tertiary care center. And people will require close follow-up, post-op care, very aggressive physical therapy and rehab for several weeks after joint replacement. And that scares the heck out of them. and they will keep delaying it. So the access is both determined by, you know, who they can get to, but also determined by the competing priorities that a lot of my patients have. And again, I'm not trying to say that this is a patient choice versus provider choice. These are true barriers that they have from the socioeconomic and their resident status that directly impacts their access to the surgery, which can actually lead to significant gains in quality of life and reduction in pain and a much better function, and for them to be socially participating and having an enjoyable life.
So at the outset, we suggested that these barriers or factors related to disparity are independent of disease. And so some people suggest or at least try to argue that the prevalence of arthritis and the severity of arthritis surely contributes to some of this. But are the findings that you're talking about related to disparity independent of those biologic factors?
I think they are. And I think there's a couple of pieces of evidence that support that statement. Number one, when you look at the most important outcome after total joint replacement, which are pain, function, quality of life, these elective procedures, people have them done not because they're dying, not because it's a life-saving procedure, but because it's a quality of life preserving procedure. So people elect to have them. And if you look at many studies, including the one that was published in the journal Osteoarthritis and Pain, Cartilage Recent, and some other similar journals in the past, you will see that when you look at post-operative pain function and other outcomes, that these are adjusted for baseline pain function quality of life, which means that you already have accounted for all the disease severity, not only disease severity, but the impact of disease and the impact of disease factors and even comorbid condition factors on the baseline pain function quality of life. And yet, even after adjusting for that, we find that disadvantaged groups still do much worse. In some other studies, elegantly done by our colleagues, they've been able to adjust for the severity of osteoarthritis based on X-ray reading or other such factors. And even in those studies, we find that the outcomes in disadvantaged group, whether it's socioeconomically disadvantaged or by rural location, by race, ethnicity, or by insurance, no insurance, or the type of insurance, that you adjust for all these other differences to the extent that you can, which will you know, adjust for access sometimes, and will adjust for definitely for baseline arthritis impact, not just severity, that these differences persist in many, and I would say most of these studies, which supports that even though we know that osteoarthritis is severe, slightly more frequent in minorities, it does not explain the differences in access, which should be more. Because if you have more severe arthritis, it's more frequent, then the minorities should have more access and they should have more surgeries. And on the other hand, if you adjust for all the baseline pain function, quality of life, and radiographic severity of osteoarthritis, you still find these significant differences in disadvantaged groups. So I do not think that explains away the poor outcomes in our disadvantaged group, whether it's income, socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, or rural, urban, low in residence, or by insurance type or access to insurance.
You've convinced me. Now, I guess just to quickly sum, because we've spoken a little bit about the outcomes from surgery themselves. Is it fair to say that people who present from a lower socioeconomic class, from rural areas, from certain ethnic groups, particularly African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asians compared to Caucasians, present with disease that's oftentimes been present for longer, is more severe, their function is worse, oftentimes they have greater comorbidities, and despite all of that, when they go on and have the surgery, unfortunately, potentially as a consequence of the lateness of presentation or the severity of the disease, the gains that they make are not as great. Would that be fair to say?
So I think that I will just qualify. I think most of what you said, I agree with. They will gain similarly to their counterparts, to their white counterparts or to their urban dwelling counterparts, but they're starting with much lower scale. And the incremental gain, in some studies, the gains are similar, and in many studies, the gain are slightly more, but they're so far behind their white counterparts or their urban counterparts that the final scores, where they need to get, the state of their health, it never catches up. So they're coming in much worse, and they're coming out still quite worse with no significant catching up. So, you know, they're going from a score of, let's say, 20 to a 70 instead of going from a score of 30 to a 95. So they might gain as much, they might gain numerically slightly more. So the delta or their increase may be numerically slightly higher, but they're so far behind. Their physical status is so much worse. Their muscle strength is so much worse. Their coordination is so much worse. They've already altered their biomechanics so much and strained their back and the other knee and the other hip for an extra 5 to 7 years. And so a combination of a lot of those factors then I think adds up to the final outcome nowhere close to a person who's not disadvantaged. So they do improve. The deltas are just as much or maybe sometimes slightly numerically better, but the final state where they get to is not that great. And this sort of reminds me of Maxim Dugudo's, I think, the statement he made for rheumatoid arthritis some time ago that it's good to be better, but it's better to be good, meaning that the state of good is more important than the improvement you get. So the final result, where you get to finally, am I able to climb 2 flights of stairs? It does not matter if you took me from going from 1 step or from 5 steps, but would I be able to climb those flight of stairs at my home, or do I need to sell this house and get to a place where I cannot climb stairs? So the final state actually does matter a lot to every human being because that determines their independence. The amount of change matters, but not as much. Yeah. I don't know if I've made it clear or not.
No, it's wonderfully clear. And I think particularly that example around their functional independence and the reality that it has on people's lives is so, so important. So, Jazz, you and others have examined this for years, and the literature is extensive in this area, in painting a picture where inequity or disparity is quite stark and profound and obviously is leading to worse outcomes. What can be done?
I think it's a $1 million question, and I think it's time for us to do things because I think you're right. We have already provided enough evidence over several decades that there are significant gaps and there are a lot of sources of gaps. So I think that we need to have dialogue with our policymakers to help level the playing field. We need them to come out with hospital or plan incentives that provide better access to people from all walks of life to these services. We need education. I think we need to educate not only the masses about the benefits of earlier access, earlier diagnosis, and earlier decision to access the right therapy, whether that's physical therapy rehab in some cases and joint injections, or whether that's a joint replacement for another patient. It's not going to be the same answer, but I think they need to have all those options available to them, regardless of their race, ethnicity, their income, their residence. I also think that there probably needs to be some sort of an innovative partnerships, I think, between employers and hospital/healthcare systems, whereby having a healthier workforce by providing them access to these sort of things early on benefits businesses and employers. And they should partner with initiatives both to expand access, but also to educate their workforce about this. You know, prevention of workforce injury may also be a significant factor because as much as we talk about osteoarthritis, a lot of that might be contributed to by workforce injury. So some sort of prevention is also, I think, in some ways, another way to tackle this. If we can provide in ergonomic workplaces to all our workers, we can probably prevent some of this. I know that that's probably a longer term commitment and takes a lot of resources. I also think that we need to start, in addition to physical ed programs in schools, I think we need to start muscle training or walking programs at elementary school levels and other early school programs to help people understand how to get trained and how to preserve muscle and joint function. Again, I know I'm talking about prevention, but I think some of these things have to be brought in some innovative way and in our school system and in a workplace. Because as much as we can try and we should try to provide equal access to healthcare and better access to healthcare through healthcare programs, policy, hospital, patient education, provider education, I think we need to take a step back and think about other more sustainable ways whereby other entities and other players in the society can come together to help us prevent this epidemic and also help people, you know, retain good function and have muscle training as part of their growing up.
Yeah, no, it's so important. I mean, obviously, healthcare systems are strained as they are, and if we increase access with no thought given to prevention, it's only likely to further burden an already overwhelmed healthcare system in many instances. Jazz, just teasing that out a little bit further, some studies suggest that up to a third or 40% of people that have joint replacements are receiving them inappropriately, and potentially we're not doing a good enough job triaging or identifying the right people to have surgery and allocating that equitably according to clinical need. Is there a role for looking more closely at appropriateness as one method of addressing the disparities that you're talking about?
Well, I think that is, I agree with that observation, and it's been, again, replicated in several healthcare systems across the world. So as much as there is underutilization among minorities, there's also an overuse and inappropriate delivery of these joint replacements to people who may not need them. I would break that down in sort of two parts. One is, it is probably true that for some people who may not need it but have access to it, it could be provided that information, and then in certain healthcare systems that will work, where there is access is based on need. However, in some other healthcare systems that are peer-based, or such as in the U.S., I think as long as you have healthcare insurance or resources, you have access to have anything done almost at any point in time if someone would agree to do that, and it's paid for. So I think that there are incentives for people, for providers to do these procedures, and many patients are likely accessing it when they may not need it or when they may not benefit from it as much. I think we have some gaps in terms of knowing and understanding who's most likely to benefit from these procedures and what's the best time too. And so we need some more tools to help us do that. But I think having that as a goal and then making these procedures more equitable could certainly be achieved by cutting out the overuse and the inappropriate use in populations. I also think that a better understanding of who will not benefit from joint replacement based on some solid research, which is still lacking despite a lot of great efforts, would go a long way. You know, patients can be provided with what is a real scenario for them with that procedure, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, with more accuracy than what we can do. We do not have great models at this time, David, as you know, to predict people who are going to end up with worse outcomes and no improvement. We at least need to don't know that, so we can provide them, say, you know, that probability of that outcome, and then hopefully offer them other less invasive things that might be available that they may want to try. We certainly don't have solid prediction models and good biomarkers, so to say, that can help us at this time. But I think the search is on for that, and we are all yearning to have. I think orthopedic surgeons of all people want to have that. They want to operate on people who will benefit, and they really do not want to operate on people who will not benefit. I think it's hard for them to tell, and any advance in that field would also help us greatly in sort of reducing some of these disparities, and also even further optimizing the outcomes of joint replacement procedures.
Wonderful, Jas. So obviously, thank you so much for explaining what is a very, complex area. Is there anything else you wanted to say specifically about disparities in joint replacement before I get into a couple of the closing questions?
I think the one thing that I will say to all patients and all people suffering from these conditions who are considering joint replacement surgeries is that there's probably two factors that they should always take into account when they're considering joint replacement. And I think the surgeon volume of joint replacement surgery and the hospital volume for joint replacement surgery are universally two of the very, very important factors that determine the short-term perioperative or during the surgery on the surgery complications and outcomes, but also long-term outcomes, I think, in many cases. And that should be one of the things that they can easily research and get information on as they're considering these procedures. Now, I know this is not easy for patients who are living in rural areas where they might want to go only 60 miles to the nearest town, and there may be only two orthopedic surgeons. But probably for people who don't have that humongous a barrier, this is a worthwhile consideration because, you know, these procedures are humongously successful, but they're far more successful when the surgeon is most experienced and when patients access this early and they have good muscle to what some people do as prehab, some doing some strengthening before surgery. And obviously there is the post-operative rehab that everybody does.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really important point to try to identify, as you suggested, what we might otherwise frame as a higher volume surgeon and a higher volume center as predictors of people who might provide better outcomes and fewer rates of complication. And if people want to, I guess, dig further into things that you might want to think about prior to a joint replacement and the appropriateness of such, please go to some of the earlier episodes with Gillian Hawker or alternatively with Peter Chung and Michelle Darcy. Now, Jas, why do you do what you do? What's your primary motivation?
I think the motivation is to make a difference in somebody's suffering, to see if what I do can make one person a little happier, a little more content with life after they met me than before they met me, or after our work is done, after I retire, if I can say there's one person in whose life our work made a difference, I think that's very much worth it. And that's also one of the reasons I enjoy being in the clinic, because sometimes at the end of the day, I'll say, well, I think this one patient I really was able to get through and overcome this. So through research, I also aim for the same thing. And so if we can make a difference in one person's life, I think all the research is still worth it.
Yeah, it's enormously satisfying. And as you say, something that I think most clinicians find immensely rewarding, and hopefully you continue to make an immense difference as you already are. Jas, is there any one piece of advice, knowledge, or wisdom that you'd like to give for people that have osteoarthritis in parting?
Wisdom I'm still seeking, so I won't try to give. I think my plea to people with osteoarthritis is that be an advocate, because the disease that you're fighting is not an easy one. And it may not be seen as something that shortens your life. It certainly is a condition that takes happiness and independence out of your life, which are by far the most important things that human beings need. Then human beings need independence and happiness. And this is a condition that will do to a lot of, you know, take that away from a lot of my patients. So you don't have to minimize your condition or the suffering from it. Bring it to the attention of your family members, to your providers. Be an advocate with policymakers, your senators, your congressmen, your representatives. Tell them this disease does matter, that we do need to have significant advances in this treatment of this condition. I think seek help and educate us. I mean, we all learn from you as you tell, come here and come to clinics and tell us and share your experiences. So I think, yeah, don't suffer in silence. Be an advocate and be heard. And sometimes we're in a hurry, but stop us and grab us by the arm and say, no, you haven't done what I need you to do. And that's a good thing. We'd like to have patients do that to us. And hopefully we can be part of the solution as we look at, you know, years and decades to come.
Wonderful way to conclude with that really important message about people empowering themselves and being proactive about their care. Jazz, thank you so much for spending some really important, insightful time about this very complex and controversial area and sharing the insights, and continue to make the massive differences that you're already making to this really important area.
David, it's been a true pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
So we've known about these disparities now for decades as it relates to osteoarthritis, and we find that people who are of African American descent or who are Hispanic or Asian have worse disease, oftentimes worse access to surgeons, worse access to joint replacement, and worse outcomes, along with our rural counterparts and people who have less income from lower socioeconomic classes. Those aspects of disparity are not changing. And in fact, in many developed nations around the world, the divide is only increasing. Our policymakers, our healthcare providers need to do more. We need to do better appropriate allocation of surgery and appropriate access to surgeons and provision of care for people with arthritis. This is not going away. And as mentioned, it's only continuing to get worse and continues to provide great cause of discomfort and suffering for people that have osteoarthritis. And it's something we can do something about, so we should. Thank you again for your continued support of the Joint Action Podcast. If you have an opportunity to speak to a member of parliament, to your local payer, your health insurer, and lobby or advocate for people who are in a position of, in this instance, oftentimes greater need, please do. Between now and when we next speak, please do take care of yourself.
Thanks for listening to Joint Action with David Hunter. If you like our show and want to know more, visit www.jointaction.info. If you have any questions, you can email us at hello@jointaction.info and follow us on Twitter @jointaction.org. This podcast was hosted by David Hunter, edited by Vicky Duong, music produced by Jordan Hunter. The information posted on this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. Anyone seeking medical advice should consult a health professional.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.